Hey, it's me, Brian Reeves. Have you ever considered working with a coach? Like maybe you've achieved success on the outside, but deep fulfillment is still missing inside? Or you're confronted with a massive challenge or choice in your life? Or your relationships aren't as fulfilling as you want them to be? Or maybe you're just tired of trying to figure life out all by yourself? Well, I invite you to apply for private one-on-one coaching with me. Since 2012, I've helped 1,000 men and women like you break through hidden barriers, deepen their relationships, especially the relationship with themselves, and step more fully into the life they were meant to live. Coaching isn't about getting advice. It's about deep transformation so that you can really hear and trust the wisdom and clarity already always within you. I only take on a few clients at a time, and I only work with men and women truly ready to do the work. So if you're up for an inner adventure as a pathway to meaningful change in your outer world, go to brianreeves.com/coaching, click an application link on that page to apply. That's Brian Reeves, Brian with a Y, reeves.com/coaching. The breakthrough you need could begin today. All right, let's get into today's episode.
So if somebody says to me, actually, I just said an incorrect statement, dad deprivation is not the single biggest cause of the boy crisis. It's the second biggest cause of the boy crisis, bad communication that leads to the divorces, that leads to the dad deprivation is the number one cause of the boy crisis.
Welcome to Men This Way. I'm your host, Brian Reeves, Brian with a Y, Reeves. I'm the author of two books and a professional relationship coach and men's coach since 2012. Alongside me as co-host is my lifelong best friend of over 40 years, Tate Arendt. And together we dive deep into the challenges and opportunities we're all facing in the world today. Here we have raw, unfiltered conversations about the topics that matter most to us, like intimacy, purpose, parenthood, spirituality, and much more. Our mission is to reveal the wisdom, insights, and practical tools to empower you to live your best life. All right, let's dive. Welcome to Men This Way. I am honored to present our guest today, a fascinating man and elder, Dr. Warren Farrell. Dr. Farrell is a visionary who spent a lifetime exploring the complexities of relationships, gender dynamics, and human connection. His work began in the feminist movement of the 70s, advocating for women's rights and serving on the board of NOW, the National Organization for Women. He's also been a leader and pioneer in the movement to understand and give language to the challenges and struggles of modern men. And along his way, his views have at times been fully embraced by society and other times considered provocative and controversial. Dr. Farrell is the author of 7 books. I think, is that right? 7 books?
Get the number? I forget which.
Something like that. He's a whole bunch of books, including the New York Times bestseller, Why Men Are the Way They Are, the international bestseller, The Myth of Male Power, and The Boy Crisis, Why Our Boys Are Struggling and What We Can Do About It, which he co-wrote with author John Gray. His latest book is Roulemate to Soulmate, in which Dr. Farrell invites us into what he calls an evolutionary shift. It's one that redefines love and partnership in a world of evolving gender roles and ever-increasing expectations. So, Dr. Farrell, welcome to Men This Way, sir. It is truly an honor to have you with us.
It's an honor to be with you. The work that you're doing that you explained to me just before we got on the air is really inspiring and exactly what I am so spending my life working with.
We were having a conversation. I said, wait a second, we need to get going because we were also, you know, Tate was mentioning how when we conceived of this podcast back in 2018, it was conceived from the awareness of where are all the elders? We as men, we don't really have exposure to elders. And you know, you, sir, you're an elder. You've lived a varied and fascinating and eclectic life. You've been in the midst of some of the most important conversations I think our culture has to be having. Tate was saying we created this podcast 4 years ago so that you could be here today. And it's true. I mean, your
purpose is where we're going. How do we develop a balanced human being inside of all of us? And how we bridge that gap from heroic intelligence to health intelligence.
Yeah, you give me chills as you talk, because we're talking about the most important conversations. And as an elder, you spent a lifetime not just studying, but supporting women. You've not just spent a lifetime of studying, but supporting men, and now really leaning into helping couples and lean into their most important relationships. And we're, as we launch into this conversation, we are well aware that these conversations, these relationships, that we face such complexity and depth. And maybe as a way of launching into this, what's a foundational principle or way of approaching all of this that you think our listeners would be wise to hold in mind as we launch into this conversation?
I think one of the most important things is understanding that historically speaking, when we heard criticism, it was a potential enemy. And so it was biologically natural to get up our defenses and even kill the enemy before the enemy killed us. And that was really functional for survival. It's just dysfunctional for love. So overcoming that is biologically unnatural. It doesn't take, and it does not happen with going to a workshop and being told it's important to not be defensive in response to criticism. It happens from, when I would say that at workshops, every couple would agree with me and say, yes, I'm really going to do that differently. And but one of the best things I've done with my workshops is I have everybody in the workshop invited to a free follow-up phone call about what worked and what didn't work a few months later and then a year or two later. And so as I went over what worked and what didn't work, I found that over and over again, when a criticism appeared, that wisdom disappeared. And so I realized I had to have that workshop work in such a way that people practiced that experience of not being defensive in response to criticism. And because it is biologically unnatural to do, it takes a lot of practice. It takes a lot of discipline. But the good news is that it's really worth it. And I've been able to set up, with the book comes an online video that people can actually practice again and again. It ain't easy, but when your partner feels that she or he doesn't have to walk on eggshells to say something to you that they're a little bit concerned about, because even though from their perspective, it's a concern that if expressed will increase in the intimacy in a relationship, their partner experiences it as a criticism that means that you don't have much respect for them, or you're going to put them down, or therefore, how could that person love you if they don't have that respect for you, and therefore you become defensive, so you don't lose that respect, lose that love, but in fact, the exact opposite happens. And so your part, usually men and women, and in gay couples, the same difference. Each gay person in the couple says, I just feel like I'm walking on eggshells. And so that is what I set out to give people the practice to evolve from the natural defensiveness to being able to leave their partner feeling heard and seen, no matter who they were or what they had to say or how distorted their memory of the issue is, or how much you disagree with it. The more it's disagreed with, the more that partner needs your security, your ability to listen until they have had a chance to express their feelings. And then they need to know that you really heard what they said and give them permission to say whether you distorted anything or whether you missed anything, and an invitation to add more.
I'm aware, Tate, you and I, just the other day, we did it. We were 2 hours with a group of men in our Elevate Your Relationship course, talking about defensiveness for 2 hours, right? Mm-hmm. We probably had a dozen men in there. To a man, every man struggles with defensiveness. And
to a woman, every woman does too, for slightly different reasons and also for mostly overlapping reasons.
Mm. Say more about the differences of the reasons.
When every man knows on some intuitive level that if a woman doesn't respect him, she cannot love him. And so when he's criticized, the fear is that she's lost respect for him. So he begins to become defensive in the hope that he can prevent her from having those feelings that she just expressed, without realizing that the best way that she, you know, that those feelings are inside of her, they're sort of like poison in a pitcher, and she needs to be able to pour them out before he has anything to say. And once she pours them out, it often disappears out of that pitcher, like the poison disappears out of that pitcher. And she's and once she knows she's heard, she has begins to have enormous respect for the fact that she was just given that space to share what she shared, and that he came back and said, "Yeah, what I'm hearing you say is this, and does that really work for you? And is, you know, is, did I distort anything there?" And there's an invitation to share that. That then increases the respect she has from him, and the enormous amount of security that women want to be safe in saying whatever they wish to say. Conversely, when a man expresses his feelings and it's critical of her, oftentimes she doesn't feel protected by him, and so there's some that makes her feel scared and unprotected, and because she married somebody that she really wants to him to be there for her, but if he's not there, but it doesn't appear when she's being criticized that he is there for her, and so but it all amounts to the same hill of beans, which is that, you know, when for slightly different but overlapping reasons, we fear being criticized.
Protected versus respected is a simple way of.
Yes. Good. Very good. Nice.
And Tate, I have a question to step out a little bit on this. All men and women are essentially bringing in this to relationships. I'm curious to step back and look at it from the perspective of the boy crisis, you know, and you talk about not fatherlessness, but the lack of presence of fathers. I mean, I'm a perfect study case for that. I haven't really had a relationship with my father for the last 25 years. And just a year and a half ago, I finally, you know, I didn't cut the man off. I would never cut him off, but I stopped seeking relationship where there was no reciprocal relationship really happening. And so, you know, and he left when I was 4, and he just really was a fantasy in my life, my birth father, for most of the rest of my life, really. So I've grown up with that father hunger. I think one of my teachers had, maybe Robert Bly was maybe, he was the man, I can't remember who exactly, but you know, redefined where there used to be father anger, it has been replaced largely with father hunger, you know, men of a certain age. And I'm curious, like, what's the relationship here between what us men are carrying into our adult relationships, you know, in particular our intimate relationships, and the boy crisis that certainly men of our generation and perhaps still even still today, you know, boys, the boy crisis, what's the link there? That's a big question.
Absolutely. The link between the roommate to soulmate and the boy crisis is basically this. The boy crisis has about 10 different causes to it, but the single biggest cause is dad deprivation, that the boy crisis resides where dads do not reside, more than any of the other 9 or 10 causes. The and the connection between the role mate to soulmate work and the boy crisis is that that when a couple, that the Achilles heel of all human beings is that inability to handle personal criticism without becoming defensive. And so, and there is in the role mate to soulmate book, there's about 22 other what I call love enhancements. But when couples aren't able to hear each other effectively, their relationship begins to, you know, develop in a walking on eggshells type of style. And then, you know, the men and women, you know, they get involved in different activities and sort of just tolerate each other. They sort of play roles in the relationship. And eventually, sometimes they get into fights because particularly men tend to not express their feelings if they don't feel they're going to be hurt at all. So they just shut up and then they start drinking. And then one day the woman says something a little bit that pushes him over the edge. And then he just, a volcano erupts. And sometimes that erupts in domestic violence, and sometimes that just erupts in shouting. But either way, it's very scary. And so then that relationship leads to divorce. And then in divorce, sometimes divorces are fine and the couples work out a really amicable arrangement. But many times if they don't, they go to court, the woman has to fight. The woman has the right to the children from the court's perspective, and the man has to fight for the children to a much greater degree. And so oftentimes that leads to the children losing contact with their dad. And then that leads to the dad deprivation that is the single biggest cause of the boy crisis. So if somebody says to me, I just said an incorrect statement, dad deprivation is not the single biggest cause of the boy crisis. It's the second biggest cause of the boy crisis, bad communication that leads to the divorces, that leads to the dad deprivation, is the number one cause of the boy crisis. And so one of my incentives in doing the Role Mate to Soulmate in book form after 30 years of doing it in workshop form was that I really wanted every couple to be able to have the tools that they needed to be able to prevent that divorce from beginning to begin with, not only because it prevented dad deprivation, but also because I think it's the greatest gift a parents can give to their children is a role model for how to solve problems without becoming defensive and being able to go from the problem level to, wow, we now have we've done checks and balance parenting here where both of us feel we've given the best to our child rather than we've given an argument to our child that can't be solved. And both of you have shouted at each other and walked different ways and not spoken to each other in any real way for a few days.
You know, Dr. Farrell, I want to go down this rabbit hole of the dad deprivation, and I want to come back to this conversation around even the idea that there's a boy crisis, because the listener might in their own mind have thoughts about what that means. Let's start there. What does it even mean? What's the evidence that we are having a boy crisis right now?
There are 70 some odd different metrics on which boys are falling behind both girls and also where they used to be as boys. So for example, when boys and girls are 9 years of age, they don't commit suicide very often. And when they do, it's about equal numbers. But between the ages of 10 and 14, boys are twice as likely as girls to commit suicide. Between the ages of 15 and 19, boys are four times as likely as girls to commit suicide. Between the ages of 20 and 24, 4.5 to 5 times as likely as girls to commit suicide. When they become men that are older at the age of 85, men are 1,750% as likely to commit suicide as women at 85 or older. Now, there's two things. You know, some people know about the suicide data when they're young. Very few people know about it when they're old. But that's just one example of many. Let's go to opioid overdose deaths. That's about a ratio of twice as many males as females. Take the prison population, 93% males. And what that tells you about the mental health that leads to acting out. Addiction to video games, much more likely to be males. Playing video games is actually quite healthy at the 5 hour per week or so level. At the 15 hour per week level, it's far more likely to move into the addiction mode. It's at that level that boys are far more likely to be addicted at that 15 hour or more per week level of video game playing. In school, Boy, almost all your, you know, a very high percentage now of your valedictorians of your honor society people are female. Boys are, particularly dad deprived boys, are far more likely to drop out of school. Dad, by the way, I was mentioning the suicide statistics. The single biggest predictor of boys committing suicide is dad deprivation. A good part of your mass shooters are obviously males. This is the anger behind most male shooters that is just very apparent. They feel lonely. They feel isolated. That usually their parents have had a divorce or have a very bad marriage. Very often they're dad deprived, especially the school shooters. When it comes to dropping out of school, we're now at the place where girls and women are about 60% of attendees of college and graduates of college. Boys are a little bit more likely than that to go to college to begin with. But even in college, with affirmative action for boys now, boys are still 10% more likely to drop out of college during the college years. And the problems there, the IQs of males have gone down by 15 points since the 1980s. Whereas normally speaking, every generation has an increase in IQ of 10 points or more. So instead of having an increase in IQ, our IQs have gone down. Our sperm counts have gone down by 60% since the 1980s. Here's a really good example of the impact of this. When the sperm count goes down, that predicts less healthy children. Less healthy children does not mean less healthy boys. It means less healthy boys and girls. And it's a good example of how when one sex loses, both sexes lose. Boys and girls are in college, and young men and women are in college. And the ratio in college it's predicted in about 10 years from now, 10 or 15 years from now, the ratio in college will be 2 females to 1 male. If there's 2 females to 1 male, the average female in college is experiencing herself competing for that small percentage of males that are there compared to the other females. And so she's having to, so many women are protesting that they want to find a college and go to a college where there's an approximately equal numbers of males and females so that they're not finding themselves having to compromise what they want to be in order to bend over backwards to get the small percentage of males that are there. And that's another example of how when only one sex wins, both sexes lose. We need each other. We want each other. This doesn't mean that there should only be heterosexual men and women. Gay men and women are very important to support and be total permission for that. But among men and women, among those who are heterosexual and attracted to the other sex, there's a desire that when women marry and they look for a father, they don't go searching on employment lines. They don't go searching in their parents' basements or other parents' basements. And boys today are far more likely, there's 67, 68% of the people who live in their parents' home after the age of 30.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, you know, our listener, Brian, mentioned
this. That's just the tip of the iceberg, by the way.
Really. Yeah. That's Brian mentioned in the intro, you know, obviously you actually began our listeners might be surprised to hear after, you know, your wealth of knowledge here, that you began your career as really a prominent feminist. And yeah. Back in the 1970s. So I'm super curious, what was the moment or series of realizations that led you to shift your focus really towards the crisis of boys and the struggle of men?
Yeah, very good question. Yes. And first of all, I always have and always will support the empowerment of women. And that's, to me, crucial. I mean, there's so many young women in my high school class that, you know, that were brighter than I was and had their act together. But, you know, they didn't, you know, I'm 81. And in those years when they were in high school, the guidance counselors were telling them what, you know, women were expected to do. And, you know, they had You know, 5 or 6 professional opportunities, but you know, one of them would have been a really great scientist, and another one would have been a very a wonderful studier of the world, and particularly China. And so, but they weren't encouraged to go into those professions. And my sister was, you know, would often say she was 2 years younger, and she was, you know, sometimes interested in guys, but she wasn't really given lots of permission to sort of psychologically to reach out and, you know, tell the guys that she was interested in, you want to go to a dance with me or whatever. That was not proper in those years. And so when the feminist movement made those things something that they were in favor of, I was feeling very supportive of that, and always have been, always will. What I don't feel good about is when the feminist movement moved more from I am woman, I am strong, to I am woman, I've been wronged. I knew that they were getting more power because, you know, when you plead to be a victim and you're a female, you get supported. But victim power is not the type of power that increases our respect for women. I wanted there to be a hashtag Me Too, because that was permission for women to express feelings. But I didn't want there to be a hashtag Me Too without having a hashtag Men Too, because both genders have their feelings and they're being left out. The main difference is that men have learned to repress them more effectively and fully as part of masculinity, which is all the more reason that men need to be able to share with the world what they're feeling inside, and what and why women need men who are sharing with the world what's inside of them. Because men who don't share, men who repress feelings, are men who will come out with the domestic violence, who will explode with volcanoes, or you'll have a father or grandfather that drank himself practically to death because he just couldn't handle what was going on inside of him that he didn't feel permission to talk about. So that was, I began to start seeing some of those things. The second thing is I remember being over in Japan talking about one of my first books, and the about Why Men Are the Way They Are book. And the and afterwards, a teacher comes up to me and says, you know, Dr. Farrell, you know, what you're saying is really, and this was, I was speaking completely from a feminist perspective. In my classroom, I'm a teacher in Japan, and in my classroom, the boys are having more problems than the girls. And then my sister, who was an elementary school teacher, also said, you know, when divorces happen, oftentimes I notice the boys really going from being quite productive to very unproductive and sort of indifferent and negative and so on. And so a lot of clue. And as I went to, you know, places like Australia and other places in the world, I started seeing that globally speaking, boys were having a lot of challenges and that nobody was talking about this. And so I began to put that on my radar. And then the more I looked at it, the more I went, wow, this is really something that needs to be spoken about. But when I was on the board of NOW and first discovered this, and this is back in the 1970s now, and I first started beginning to see some of these things, I started to talk with the board members about it, particularly that children of parents who are divorced, and that where the children did not have much father involvement, that these boys, the boys in particular, were doing quite badly. NOW was not excited about my talking about that because they wanted their NOW members to be the feminists to be able to have the freedom to be the one that made the decision about what happened in the marriage and to move where they wanted to move, even if it was out of state and away from the father. And so I just started to say, you know, this is not the best thing for the children. And they looked at me like, you know, are you one of us or not? And you know, 90% of my speaking referrals were coming from feminists. And so I was doing very well financially. And so I knew that I would be taking, if I pursued this, articulation of the challenges that boys were having, that I, you know, would lose many millions of dollars.
Yeah. Well, I'm coming back to this conversation that we were in about this dad deprivation, because I think for our audience, in the way that you're articulating this, that I really see that there's two different types of dad deprivation that gets created. One is the deprivation that happens inside of a divorce scenario, a separation, where even if it is split, children are spending more time with their moms or more quality time with their moms. But the other is more what perhaps Brian and I experienced and what many men experience, which is my parents were together, but, and my father was the provider of the home, and outside of providing, his presence was largely missing. He did the best he could and showed up in all the ways that he could. But there's two different types of deprivation, right? One that's created inside of divorce or separation. The other is inside of other roles that get taken and men being not as present as they need, as their children need them to be. And so maybe, you know, I guess my question around this is that what is it about a father's presence that is so vital to a young boy's development?
Before we go there, I also want to, I'm glad we're staying here on this dad deprivation thing, because one of the things that I noticed in my younger life as well is, so I graduated in high school. I was the top male graduate in my class. And I was number seven. There were six girls, young women.
All above you.
Who were above me in that sort of, you know, just from a GPA standpoint. I don't know, you know, what that necessarily means, but I was very successful in a way. You know, I was, again, doing great in school. I performed. I was, you know, different sports teams. I went into ROTC in college. I graduated there, the top of my class in college with an engineering degree, went into the military, was a captain in the Air Force, got a master's degree in human relations. Like, I'm crushing it in a way.
Yeah, you are.
And yet I was suffering from a profound inferiority complex of sorts, like that would show up in various ways, especially in my relationships with women, but also in my relationships with other men. You know, I was just, everyone else was on a pedestal in some way in my mind, you know, and I wrote this, in my book, there's this chapter, the title is, Without a Father's Praise, a Man Will Never Feel Successful Enough. And so, you know, Tate's dad stayed in the home, although he worked all the time. My dad was gone. And I'm curious, but before, like, you know, Tate's asking, what is a father's presence? Why is it so meaningful and important? But one the thing I'm curious about, maybe before that, is why is a father's absence, whether his presence, whether, again, if he, even some guys, some dads are in the home, but they're checked out on TV, they're checked out into their hobbies, they're working a lot, whatever. What is it that his absence, that deprivation, what is the impact of that? Maybe before, like, why, you know, it's kind of the same question, just different side of the coin.
Yeah. Maybe one way I can express this is I'm married for the past 30 years. I've been with a woman who's my wife, and she adopted in her former marriage, adopted a daughter in a former marriage. And we had a fellow from New Zealand over who was a rancher. And I said to him, you know, give me an idea of a day at the ranch and what it's like for you. And he said, oh, a fascinating day. A time period was actually when I had in the barn 12 ducklings with their parents, and the parents were killed. And a chicken started to realize that the ducklings needed a parent, and the chicken started to parent the ducklings, which was really sweet. And that one day the barn door was open, and the ducklings were able to mature enough to waddle out, and they waddled down the hill. And and the chicken was right behind them, and the ducklings all jumped into the lake, and the mother, the female chicken just went berserk, like, what, you know, because obviously she can't swim, but the ducklings can, and she was fearful. And our adopted daughter at the table with this rancher said, "That's the way I feel every day of my life, like I'm a duckling raised by a chicken." And there's something about, you know, needing, and inside of every boy is, you know, he looks in the mirror and half of him is his mom's genes and half of him is his dad's genes. And when he has a dad absent, he doesn't really know what he is, who he is. He's like that duckling raised by that chicken. And that half of him doesn't know quite what he's about and what he's supposed to do. Now, that's one dimension of it. Another dimension of it, we have to remember also, back to your point, Tate, about that, you know, the two dimensions of that, the father being working and then also divorce. There's a third dimension to it as well, which is that 40% of women in the United States today who have children without being married. Now, certain percentage of those, small percentage of those, are living with the men that they had the children with. But that relationship lasts only an average of 3.5 years. So those children oftentimes begin to develop a little bit of a bond to dad, but then the relationship breaks up and usually the mom remains the one that connects with the children and the dad does not. And then the mom has no interest in that dad connecting with the children. And so there's that type of dad deprivation from the single moms. There's the divorce type of dad deprivation. And then there's the third type that you mentioned, Tate, of the dad being working so hard and being away from home. Now, the working so hard and being away from home is what I call the father's catch-22, where the father learns the way he should love the family is by being away from the love of the family. Now, how and why? The child is born. And the dad is a local salesperson selling product X. But he realizes that being a local salesperson is not producing enough money. So what he needs to do when that child or two or three children are born is to become a national salesperson. So now he's selling product X all around the country. And the child has a recital or a birthday, and the dad just can't get back in time for it, or just is missing a week at a time, or he's just so involved with his work in order to be able to support the children and give you opportunities he never had, whether he's a cab driver. So the average cab driver or Uber driver, a very high percentage of them, works 70 hours a week to be able to earn enough to be able to support a family on cab driver type of income. And so he's not around. If he's a corporate executive or he's successful at work, he also learns skill sets that are very effective at work that are very ineffective in love. So one of the important parts of the Boy Crisis book is this discussion about the tension between what it takes to be successful in work and what it takes to be successful in love. And I can come back to that in a few moments, but I'm just going to give you the broad spectrum of that now. And so the most important thing to understand is that there's a lot of ways that there's something that I call dad-style parenting and mom-style parenting. And in the Boy Crisis, I outlined 7 of the most important differences between dad-style and mom-style parenting. So I'll give one example. So let's say you have 3 kids and those 3 kids, dad is more likely to sort of say, okay, and let's say 2 boys and 1 girl, dad is more likely to say, okay, you kids go on the couch, you jump on my back and the game here is going to be who can pin me down before I pin the 3 of you down. Okay, dad, great. This is really wonderful. And the kids are super excited. And and mom is looking on and going, oh my God, I feel like I have just one more child to monitor in the day. She's freaking out. On the other hand, she doesn't want to be too controlling and she sees that the kids are happy. So she doesn't want to, but on the other hand, she feels like, you know, guilty that she's not getting involved in protecting the children because she knows that sooner or later, she feels that sooner or later, somebody's going to get hurt. You know, she's only about 99% likely to be right. sooner or later, somebody gets hurt. And the mom is like, oh, feeling guilty that she didn't interfere and, you know, say something because look what she did. She let the children get hurt. On the other hand, she feels that, all right, dad will finally get the lesson. At least he sees that the children are going to get hurt. He's not going to put them in jeopardy again. But sure enough, the dad, you know, goes back and says, hey, listen, Jill, you can't put your finger in, Jim, you can't put your elbow in your sister's eyes like that. And if you do that again, that's going to be the end of the roughhousing. And mom is looking on and saying, wait a minute, you don't see that this roughhousing is inevitably going to lead to that. The kids are not going to pay attention to that. And so the roughhousing continues. And sooner or later, there's another time where where somebody gets hurt. And now the mother's really beside herself. But the dad says, okay, end of roughhousing. And, oh, no, Dad, I'm sorry. We didn't mean to do that. Nope. I gave you the warning. That's the end. And so the dad is doing there something called boundary enforcement. And as opposed to, and very few people get this difference, boundary setting. Moms are far more likely to set boundaries. Dads are far more likely to enforce the boundaries they set. So when that dad says, no more roughhousing and you can't talk your way out of it, you already had your warning, then the children learn the next time that if they're ready to push their somebody else aside and be really aggressive, that they're going to lose what they really want. So children are like doggies and the roughhousing is like the doggie's treat. And daddy says, you can, if you go ahead and you push, you're too aggressive versus assertive, you're going to lose your treat. And so that then the children know that because they did lose their treat the last time, that dad means what he says. And so therefore they are forced to learn a couple of things. One of them is postponed gratification. I really want to push my brother or sister out of the way, but I'm going to lose my treat if I do. Therefore, I have to postpone my gratification and get what I really want, the treat. And postponed gratification is the single biggest predictor of success or failure in life, in regular life. Second, they're learning that if I don't think of my sister or brother's need to be treated with assertiveness rather than aggressiveness, I'm going to lose what I want. So they're beginning to learn the first vestiges of empathy, not because they are inherently empathetic, but because they have no option but to think of somebody else's needs in order to get what they want for themselves. And so they are beginning to become more empathetic. They're beginning to know the difference between being assertive and aggressive, and they're beginning to get postponed gratification. And so then they go into school with postponed gratification, and they're able to complete their homework rather than get involved with video games or other activities becoming a failure to launch. And so that's just one. But the problem is that nobody explains this to children and to men and to women. So, I don't blame women mothers for not knowing this, because women mothers can't know what dads don't say. As you know, I wrote a book called Women Can't Hear What Men Don't Say. And then secondly, men can't be blamed, because one of the reasons it's in the Boy Crisis book is because I couldn't find it anywhere in self-help books or magazines for parents, that the male contribution to parenting is not available to virtually anybody. And so I felt that was really an important part of the Boy Crisis book, is to have people understand, why do dads tease? What's the positive value of something like teasing that makes my daughter or my son cry? Why do dads let children go into school without completing their homework? A mother and father that are divorced and the child is allowed to go into school without completing the homework, the mother's way of looking at that is, you let our daughter or son go to school without completing their homework. How could you? And from the dad's perspective, it's a very different scenario that arises that would allow the dad to allow the child to do that, because, if you are interested, I'll explain more about that.
This is reminding me of something that I learned about many years ago that happened in the animal kingdom at an elephant reserve in Africa, where all of the adult males had been poached. They'd been murdered, by poachers, and which left the animal herd to be largely females, adolescent females, and adolescent males. And the adolescent males, they went rampant. They went into they wreaked havoc. They attacked the females. They attacked humans more. They ravaged landscape. Like they went into a must, right? They're out of their puberty earlier. And in trying to figure out how to resolve this, what the guardians of the reserve, they simply brought in males from another reserve, adult males from another reserve. And that restored an interesting, that restored a calm and order. It's like, you know, you said something, you've said so many things that are fascinating, but like that moms set boundaries, dads enforce them. And, you know, I don't necessarily hear that in a gendered way, like women do this, men do this, but sort of that, that feminine energy expresses the boundaries that should exist in order to create safety and for life to succeed and flourish. And that more masculine energy is the one that that is decisive in making sure those get enforced and like draws the hammer down when they don't.
Yes, let me, since you brought that up again, I will expand on that. So the studies show that when children are supervised by a mom, the moms will set an earlier bedtime than when they're being supervised by a dad who will set a later bedtime. And yet, when children are being supervised, yet the children supervised by dads are actually likely to get to bed earlier. So how does that happen? So let's say it's mom says 8:30, dad says 9. And, you know, the children come up to, one of the children comes up to mom at 8:30 and says, "Oh, mom, I haven't got my homework done. I can't go to bed now." And mom says, "Well, sweetie, you know, you were playing a video game and you were talking to a girlfriend for about an hour. You could have gotten your homework done then." Yeah, I know, mom, but I'm sorry. I just didn't get it done." And so mom visualizes, "My goodness, I just can't possibly let my daughter go to school or my son go to school without doing his homework or her homework. So, okay, sweetie, you should have done it before, but go ahead and do it now. I don't want you to go to school without doing your homework." Then the child finishes the homework maybe a half hour or so later. And says, "Mom, I did my homework. Isn't that great? Can you read me a story since I did my homework?" "Well, yeah, you really were supposed to do it before, and it's a past your bedtime, but okay, I'll read you a story." And so mom reads the story, and now it's 9:30. And the child goes to school with homework done. And so now let's compare that. The dad is more likely to say, the first time usually the dad will do a warning and it will be very much like the mom. But the second time around after that warning, the dad is likely to say, "Yeah, you spent an hour playing those video games or talking with something or goofing off. You could have done your homework before. I already warned you that if you did this again, I would, you're going to go to school without your homework being done. That's your responsibility. Take responsibility for that. And the next time, you know, next time around, anything you want to do before 9 o'clock, I'll play with you. I'll roughhouse with you. I'll read you a story. I'll do anything you want, but it's got to be before 9 o'clock and it's ending at 9 o'clock. But dad, I can't possibly go to school without my homework being done. Mom will be furious at me." Well, you're going to have to pay that penalty. And so then the child begins to learn. So that's the enforcement of the boundaries that dads are more likely to do. Now understand these. Sometimes the dads are terrible at enforcing boundaries and moms are very good at enforcing boundaries. And sometimes neither is good at enforcing boundaries. And then watch what becomes of the kid. You know, somebody that is not productive, not effective in the world, does not know postpone gratification, does not develop resilience, and so on. So if you're listening to this and both mom and dad are really loving, caring, and empathetic people, and the result of that loving, caring, and empathy is that you keep repeating your boundaries, that is, you keep setting your boundaries, but you don't enforce the boundaries, what your kids will become good at is manipulation, because they'll see there's always a way of manipulating you. They'll also become less empathetic. People who bring up empathetic children are not parents who are only one-way empathizers. That is, unless one of the sections of The Boy Crisis is how to create a family dinner night without creating a family dinner nightmare. And one of the importances of that is seeing that when parents are empathetic to the children, but they don't require the children to be empathetic to them and their brothers and sisters, that the children do not become empathetic. They become self-centered. One-way empathy doth not create empathy. One-way empathy creates self-centeredness. And so the requirement for the children to be to also think of somebody besides themselves and have empathy to their brothers, sisters, and their parents is a parental responsibility that's crucial, because we all want our children to be empathetic. But empathy does not come naturally. It comes as a result of seeing that it's in your self-interest to be empathetic, and that you've seen the people around you rewarded for empathy, not just self-centeredness.
Yeah. You know, Dr. Farrell, before we press record, we were kind of sharing with you that Brian and I work with men. We have a year-long container of men that we work with 10 men. And one of the areas of life that we really help men lean into is their family life. And we focus a lot on fatherhood, right? Because very few men, given what you've shared and what Brian and I know, very few men have had elders, fathers as elders in their life to show them what it means to be a father in the ways that really children, boys and girls, need them to be. And so one of the things that Brian and I really focus on is helping men lean into becoming the fathers that they know their children need them to be, right? Not the fathers that they want to be, but developing the skills to enable them to be the fathers that their kids need them to be.
Absolutely.
So, you know, and what I'm, I guess, curious about is what do you see as the essential and evolving role for fathers in the modern family units, given that there are men, those three categories, right? There are some men that are just not able to be in their kids' lives. They're the 40% of women are having kids without fathers in the home, or short-term relationships, divorces, or men that are there but aren't fully there. So what do you see as the essential evolving role for fathers given the modern day family?
Well, first of all, we really need to get the, something that I've been part of in Florida and now in Tennessee I'm working on is developing programs that allow, in Florida, we got $70 million contributed to teaching moms and dads why dads are so important. And they're important because, first of all, when a woman is a single mother, she almost always feels overwhelmed. And so we don't want women to be overwhelmed because they feel guilty that they didn't do their job at home well. They feel guilty that they didn't do their job at work well. And they feel caught between a rock and a hard place, and they feel very frustrated and just exhausted. And so what one solution to that is helping them know that it's a woman's issue for a dad to be more involved with children, as well as a father's issue. And the people who win in those cases are the mothers, the fathers, who feel they have a new sense of purpose. We need to, and the children, who are almost always do significantly better when they have a mom and dad and parenting. We need to teach the dad and the mom both that there is a difference between dad and mom style parenting. They both have value, and both of them can go too far, because every virtue taken to its extreme becomes a vice. And the way to solve that problem as to which virtue is becoming a vice is to know how to communicate with each other, so you can most effectively hear each other and develop not father parenting or mother parenting, but checks and balance parenting. And so how do you develop checks and balance parenting? By knowing how to handle the concerns that the other parent has, and have a respect for their style. And that requires a huge amount of listening. So let's say, for example, that a child says to mom, I want to climb the tree in the backyard, okay? And mom goes, well, sweetie, no, that tree is too tall, and it's dangerous, and it's you could fall out, and you could really kill yourself or hurt yourself very badly. And so the child runs to dad and says, you know, dad, can I try to climb the tree in the backyard? And dad says, well, it's a big tree, but, you know, sweetie, be careful, okay? If you do that, and then the kid goes out and starts climbing the tree in the backyard, and mother freaks out and says, wait a minute, I just told you you couldn't do that. And, well, dad said I could. So then that's an example of where checks and balance parent is needed. Mom says something like, you know, that we don't want our son or daughter to kill themselves or get a concussion or a spinal cord injury or what. Why are you letting them climb the tree? And the dad, if he's done some of the reading of the boy crisis on these types of issues, understands that the child that climbs that tree is learning to know what's the difference between something that's safe and not, and how to protect and how to know the boundary between safety and a risk. Or if he's read more deeply, he understands that the child is actually increasing her or his IQ by moving into uncomfortable territory and having the neurons connect in ways that it hadn't connected before. But I've never heard a dad say, it's really important for the child to climb the tree because we want to have the child increase his or her IQ and that type of thing. So dads need to know these things and be able to talk with dads about them. But then once dads know these things and share them with moms, they need to be able to work out with the mom a respect for her style and vice versa, so that something like the following might happen, that the mom can say, okay, I can see that I do want my children to learn while we're around and we're protecting them, some type of balance between knowing what's safe and what's not safe and what's a risk worth taking. And I do want them to have higher IQs. But I also want them to be safe. So maybe we can agree that the child can climb the tree, but not above a certain level. And some branches are just growing and they can be especially dangerous. So we need to make sure that they don't go on those branches. And you need to be out there underneath that tree so that in case that child falls, you can cushion the fall. And by the way, give me your cell phone because I don't. It's the only way I can trust that you'll be focused on our daughter or son is when you're not focused on the cell phone. And so then the dad and mom can create a win-win situation. The child gets the best benefit. The mom gets her instinct towards safety is respected, and the dad's instinct toward the value of risk taking within a framework of safety is also respected.
Like, I just want to say, like, my wife and I, we don't have a child, but we have a dog. And this pattern shows up there 100 times. It's the same thing. She is all about preserving life and safety and minimizing risk. And I am all like, oh, come on. You know, the dog, if the dog needs to learn the hard way, not to eat that bush with thorns. You got to let it eat the bush with thorns so that it learns not to eat the bush with thorns. Whatever. It's just fascinating how primal. Yes. These patterns are. And I am curious, I don't say if you were going to this question, but given that a lot of kids are still growing up in single parent homes, right? Or they're bouncing back and forth between two parents.
Yes.
Or even in step families, you often will have a parent who doesn't necessarily know their role, right? The step parent doesn't really know how to be a parent to this child. They're more maybe hands off or timid or whatever, just trying to navigate that. How can a parent who is a parent of a child who knows, is aware their child doesn't have that kind of exposure to, you know, those balancing energies or expressions, what can that parent do to help ensure that that child still gets that healthy mix of exposure to those?
Yes. The easiest way is to have a step parent involved, like a stepdad. However, normally speaking, especially if it's a daughter, the mother's protectiveness will be dominant, and the father, the stepfather, will share some of his feelings, but he will only be an advisor. And so the mother's job is to really rethink that attitude of being only an advisor, and to really have the dad the dad's perspective on this, really balance her perspective and do that type of checks and balance parenting with the stepfather being really fully involved. Otherwise, you're making you're underusing the stepdad. And what the stepdad will end up doing is going where he's rewarded. He'll go back and work more and contribute to the family economically, and he'll be minimally involved with the raising of the children. And therefore, you will not get the full benefit of the stepfather as a parent. Second is, let's say there's no, the single biggest thing most dads, moms can do is to let the biological dad know that you have learned about his value. And remember that when every generation had its war, and in every generation's war, Uncle Sam said to men, you are needed to kill and be killed. When men are told we are needed, we will risk our life for being needed. If you are learning what dad style parenting is about, and you go to the biological dad and you say, I am sorry, I had no idea that you had this value and that value, that when you roughhoused, I just thought you were one more child to monitor, as I said before, or, you know, when you were teasing, I thought you were cruel and insensitive. Or when you were enforcing that boundary, I thought you were insensitive and cruel. But now I see the value of that. When you let the biological dad, no matter where he is, know that he's needed, he will often come back and be involved. This does not mean marrying him again. This does not mean anything romantic happening, but it means asking him if he will to live within about 20 miles of where you live, not on the same block, not in, you know, in the same two block range. But the children who do the best after divorce are ones that have four must-dos. One is that the biological dad and the biological mom are about equally involved with the children's lives after divorce. Number two, that the biological dad and biological mom live within about 20 minutes drive time from each other. Number three is that the children don't hear anything, any bad mouthing about the other parent. Because remember, half of them is the genes of the other parent. And when they feel that the other parent is bad mouthed, they worry that is really them. And fourth, if you really want to do well by your children, even if you have no interest in being with this man or this man again, biologically, to do couples communication work at least once every few weeks, not during an emergency, but because during emergencies, you both start arguing for your own perspective to the therapist. But outside of an emergency, you can begin to see the best intent of the other parent. You have time to do that. Those four must-dos and the children tend to turn out about equally, almost as well as they would in an intact family.
Well, it's really profound. I know we have probably just time for one more question, and I'll let Brian ask the final question. But because we spent most of today having a conversation really about the boy crisis, but I'm going to set a cliffhanger here, because you say the ideas in your new book, Role Mate to Soulmate, can offer a way out of the boy crisis. And, you know, I'll just plant the seed now that we would obviously love to have you come back to be able to have a much more thorough conversation around your latest book, But Brian, how do you want to bring us out?
Well, one of the things that I want to acknowledge, because, you know, as I said, this is a lot of my audience is women, and I hear from, you know, I hear the things that you've just shared, Dr. Farrell, and I realize this, it is so complex. And I mean, because one of the things that came up for me is there's going to be women that listen to this that are single moms who experience, and who may be very correct in their experience, accurate in their experience. The fathers are checked out. They're gone. They're not available. They're going to raise their kids for a long time as single parent children. And I think, you know, I just want to just, I just want to acknowledge that, and it's so complex because part of the reason I think men do check out is because we get the message over and over and over that I'm not needed. I'm not necessary, even if not from her necessarily, but from the world around us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I'm only necessary to make money, to provide resources, and that's it. Other than that, I have no value here. And so, you know, I don't, you know, it's complex. It's like, who's to blame? We're all to blame. I mean, it's a cultural collective crisis, right? That we're navigating. And so I just wanted to acknowledge that and speak to that. And cause I hear from women sometimes who lament and who are really upset and confused and like, and scared even that if I'm raising this child, are you telling me they're going to become a monster because dad's not around?
Yes. Good. You know? Very good. I'm really glad you ended with that. So first of all, let me be clear. That while children who have problems are very frequently dad deprived, many children raised by single moms do just fine. So being raised by a single mom does not predict a negative outcome, although children with negative outcomes are frequently raised without their dad involved, with dad deprived. So those two things are not in conflict.
Yeah. And just want to acknowledge, like, hey, women listening, I was raised by a single mom. I got issues. Let's not deny that. I got shit to overcome, no doubt. But I turned out okay. My wife will vouch for me, I promise. It's not all hope is not lost.
Yeah. Would you get your wife out here and make sure that she
verify this?
You're a perfect, really seriously, Brian, you're an extremely good example of that.
Thank you. Thank you.
And then second, let's say there's no chance of getting a father or a stepfather involved. Then spend time with that portion of the Boy Crisis book on dad style parenting. You can know how to tease effectively. You can, in a way that benefits the child, you can learn how to enforce boundaries. You can learn how to do roughhousing with the kids. You can see the importance of it and create a discipline where you're doing that. So that's you alone. Also, try to find male role models. Make sure your child, your children are involved in sports. And make sure that you know the coaches of those children and talk to the coaches, particularly your son, of explaining that there is no dad around. A coach that is told that this boy, your son, does not have a dad around and needs two things. One is for that coach to find out what's good about your son and share with your son directly and verbally what's good about him. And then second, also being honest with your son about a shortcoming that he has. And when he knows that coach cares and knows what's good about him, then he will be open to modifying his behavior about the things that are his shortcomings. Second or third, whatever it is, if you're at all inclined, even if you are not inclined to believing in God, it is helpful to get your children involved in some type of religious experience that is not, you know, an extreme one, but some place where a minister, priest, rabbi, or a mom can get together other boys about your son's age and have them meet with each other and express feelings and express fears. So it should be somebody that you vet as a good facilitator who has had some experience in getting boys together in small groups, like a 7 or 8, where they talk about their feelings and their fears with other boys. Because the single biggest thing that boys learn when they hear other boys talk is that their loneliness, their fears are not theirs alone. And the security that comes when you see that is very helpful. So a community of faith can be, as long as it's not an extreme dogmatic community, can be very effective. Again, even if you do not believe in God, that can be helpful to your children. And so these are just a few of a number of things that you can do I outline quite a few in the Boy Crisis book because I'm very concerned that the children who don't have dads, that they're not, it's not like you don't have a biological dad, you're done for. That's absolutely not the case.
And we'll
Brian really is a great example of
that. Thank you. We'll put the links to your books as well that we've mentioned here in the show notes for the episode. We're going to wrap up. This is just, again, we're the tip of a very large iceberg. We would love to have you back on to talk more in depth about Rolemate to Soulmate. And for now, where can our listeners, where's the best place to learn about you, Dr. Farrell, and how
I'd, to? I'd say with? Just, you know, picking up a copy of the Soulmate book of the Boy Crisis. And fortunately, the Rolemate to Soulmate book is a 30% discount now on Amazon. But if you do pick that book up and you do have a partner, make sure you get the online video course to actually practice. The book itself only gives you wisdom. And as I said before, when criticism appears, wisdom disappears. You really have to practice the stuff. And with the Boy Crisis, really focus on the chapters around dads and also the differences between heroic intelligence and health intelligence. To try to get your child to have a good combination of mostly health intelligence.
With so much more to explore, thank you so much, Dr. Farrell, for being with us today.
It's a total pleasure to be with the two of you. I'm really happy to come back. I love the energy you both have and the way you hand off to each other in a way that is completely unselfish and very caring. It's wonderful.
We've been friends. Example. We've been besties for 40 years, since we were 10 years old. So we know each other well. There's a lot of trust that we've built up over time. And anyway, thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure.